From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Protesters air grievances with an under-the-radar flight from Vermont to Quebec to drop thousands of anti-FTAA leaflets. And in Quebec City, a ring of steel, unprecedented levels of security as tens of thousands of protesters gear up against corporate globalization. We'll speak with Canadian activists Maude Barlow, Jaggi Singh, and Philippe Hamel. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. The judge presiding over about 100 federal police corruption lawsuits in Los Angeles has ruled the city's police department can be sued as a racketeering enterprise. The ruling by U.S. District Judge Gary Fess could lead to a sharp increase in the city's financial liability from the police corruption scandal in which some members of the Rampart Station's anti-gang unit allegedly robbed, beat, framed, and shot suspects. Legal experts say the ruling is groundbreaking because no police department or major police official has ever been held liable under the Federal Racketeer Influenced and Corrupt Organizations Act. This news from Cincinnati. Five people have filed a lawsuit against Cincinnati police officers who they say attacked them without warning or provocation during last week's protests. The fatal police shooting of a 19-year-old black man, Timothy Thomas, on April 7th prompted 3 days of protests and rioting. Dozens of people were injured. More than 800 arrests were made. The mayor imposed Cincinnati's first citywide curfew since the race riots of 1968. And in New York, a police department administrative hearing begins today into the actions of the four officers acquitted last year in the shooting death of Amadou Diallo. The shooting will be reviewed by the NYPD's Firearms Discharge Review Board. It'll decide if the officers Kenneth Boss, Sean Carroll, Edwin McMillan, and Richard Murphy will face administrative charges. The four officers were acquitted last year of murder and other charges in the 1999 fatal shooting. And from Washington, gun control advocates marking the second anniversary of the Columbine High School shooting are calling on Congress to toughen laws requiring background checks. They released a report yesterday saying some states have actually made it easier to buy guns since the April 20th, 1999 shooting. The rampage in Littleton, Colorado left 15 people dead, including the two gunmen. A friend of the gunman said she bought three of the four weapons used in the shooting at a gun show without a background check. She says a check may have given her cold feet. Aaron Flynn, a junior at Columbine who was there the day of the shooting, says she still hears the gunshots and misses two friends who died. And this news from Baltimore, a lawyer known for suing the tobacco and asbestos industries is now going after cellular phone companies, alleging in new lawsuits that the companies have known about health risks for users of the phones but failed to warn them. Peter Angelos filed class action lawsuits yesterday in Maryland and three other states. The suits seek to force the wireless industry to cover the costs of headsets that Angelos says would protect users from possible radiation hazards. The suits claim there are links between cellular phone use and a host of health problems, including damage to basic brain function. This news from Istanbul, Turkey. After months of surviving on sugared or salted water, Zara Kulaksis lies on a cot in a makeshift house in the poor outskirts of Istanbul with barely the strength to talk. On the wall above her head is a picture of her 19-year-old sister, Kanan, who died of starvation on Sunday to protest the treatment of leftist prisoners in Turkey's prisons. The prisoners have been transferred to new cells where they are isolated and, according to their families, beaten daily. Despite the deaths of 14 hunger strikers, Turks and most in the West are largely ignoring the plight of Kulaksis and 230 other fasters, including 222 prisoners that are loyal to progressive groups. This news from Israel. Israeli riot police entered a disputed Jerusalem shrine today after Muslim worshippers threw stones and a Palestinian television reporter was wounded by Israeli army fire in a Gaza Strip refugee camp. Also today, Israel eased travel restrictions in the Gaza Strip. And from Johannesburg, South Africa's success in winning a landmark case against the drug industry was tempered today by signs that cheap AIDS medicines are unlikely to flood quickly into a country ravaged by the disease. The senior Navy commander in the Pacific has decided not to court-martial Commander Scott Waddell, the captain of the submarine Greenville, for his actions in the collision that sank a Japanese fishing boat off Hawaii in February, claiming the lives of 9 Japanese crew members, including 4 high school students. According to an unnamed official, the subcommander will be ordered to an admiral's mast hearing, in which he will be asked to submit a letter resigning from his nearly 20-year Navy career, although he'll depart with an honorable discharge and his rank and pension intact. And the children of Vietnam veterans exposed to Agent Orange during the Vietnam War may well be at greater risk of contracting leukemia, according to a new study. While Agent Orange has long been associated with increased incidence of various conditions and birth defects, the research is the first to make a link between the defoliant and AML, one kind of leukemia. Children who contract AML have an average life expectancy of just 2 years.
Skin and bone turn to rivers of blood. Ashes and dirt run like rivers of mud.
Soulful Warrior by Dr. John here on Pacifica Radio's Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Yesterday, anti-corporate globalization activists found a creative way to air their grievances over Quebec City. They took off in a single-engine plane from Vermont and flew under the radar through Canada and skirted the security perimeter in Quebec City, where the summit is being held. Along the route, they dropped thousands of leaflets from the plane decrying the disastrous impact of free trade agreements on democracy and the environment. Joan Roney joins us right now from Quebec City. Welcome to Democracy Now!
Hello.
Hi, are you there?
Yes, I am. Hello, Amy.
Can you tell us what you did yesterday?
Well, yesterday morning we took off from Vermont in a 2-seater airplane, and we went along the St. Lawrence River and went about 500 feet off the ground, because if you go that low, then you can't be noticed by radar. So we followed the route all the way up to Quebec City and popped up very high because there's a ceiling there, and if you go within the ceiling, supposedly you could be in trouble or shot down because it's restricted airspace. And there we, on the way up and over Quebec City, we dropped about 7,000 leaflets.
Any detection?
Surprisingly, there was nobody. We only noticed one airplane on the way back, and it looked like a recreational plane. It was across the St. Lawrence River on the other side, right near Montreal.
And what did the leaflets say?
And actually, that was our first flight. The leaflets said anti-corporate globalization activists air grievances over Quebec City, blah, blah, blah. And then it went on to top 10 reasons to oppose the free trade area of the Americas, with the last one being free trade agreements lead to militarism, and on a smaller scale, militarism has shown itself in communities of color and at protests in Seattle and now Quebec City. And it went on. It also went into the history of why we picked leafleting.
Joni Roney, the last time you were on Democracy Now! Was right after the inauguration of George Bush, where you also were involved with a very creative action. Can you summarize it for us very quickly?
Well, George W. Bush, when he took the oath of office in a private setting for a few thousand people, I say private because he needed tickets to get in, we somehow got hold of tickets, myself and this young man, and we, right when he went to take the oath of office with Chief Justice Rehnquist, we dropped our clothes and dropped our drawers and revealed signs of discontent, basically saying there's no democracy and such, hailed to the thief and things like that. That's what we did.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us. You're now in Quebec City?
No, I came back to Vermont. We did two flights, and we might do another one. Our second flight was flown over Cornwall as we watched the activists attempt to cross, U.S. activists attempt to cross into Canada, Canadian areas, and we dropped leaflets over the Royal Mounted Police and Cornwall. And we're just doing something the U.S. military has done for years in supposedly undemocratic areas. So that's why we chose to do this.
Well, I want to thank you for being with us as we do a roundup on this day of protests in Quebec City and the beginning of a weekend of protests here in the United States as well. We'll be speaking with leading Canadian activists asking protesters in this country if they had a chance to ask President Bush a question as he attends the Summit of the Americas in Quebec City, what it would be. Joni Roney, thanks for joining us. We're going to now find out what happened in a mass action yesterday against the FTAA. A caravan of 500 people drove from Burlington, Vermont, to the Agwesasne Mohawk Reservation in upstate New York. After a traditional fish fry and a discussion of how the free trade area of the Americas will impact Indigenous peoples, the Mohawk organizers then led the caravan to the Canadian border. When Canadian officials denied one activist entry, citing a history of political organizing, most of the contingent refused to cross into Canada. They said the gesture symbolized their vision of a society in which no one is left behind. We're joined now by Leslie Wood, who is with the Direct Action Network. Welcome to Democracy Now!, Leslie.
Hi.
You were a part of that caravan?
Yes, I was.
Can you tell us how it went down? We had two Mohawks on yesterday debating the issue 2 days ago of this action. Explain what happened.
As you said, we headed off from Burlington yesterday in a strong caravan and had the fish fry and the speeches. And there was, about 500 folks, lots of shiny vans. And we had made a decision at a spokes council in Burlington, Vermont, that we would not leave anyone behind. And so when we got to the border and some people were turned back, the vast majority of people returned to the United States and decided to go in their various ways. But it was a fantastic opportunity to work with allies we had within the Mohawk community and build an understanding about the issues that they're facing in terms of free trade and in terms of some of the struggles they've been going through on their reserve.
I know there was some controversy on the reservation about using Agwesasne to go across. Did you see any evidence of that?
There were a few people who were asking us to leave once we crossed, and we just kept moving. Also, I know that when the group went back to the spokes council, our allies on the reserve, some traditional Mohawks had told us that we could meet and have a spokes council back on the American side, and the Mohawk police sent everybody on their way, so they left the reserve at that point.
And what are your plans for Quebec City?
I'm actually in Quebec City right now. A couple of us had visa issues that we couldn't return to the United States. But another 10 people just showed up from Philadelphia. So there's a few people who are gradually trickling in who tried other borders. And now we'll sort of try and regroup and figure out what we can do in Quebec City today. But we had booked 160 people from New York and Philadelphia, and we have about 15 people here.
And the grounds that people were turned back?
Yes, that's right.
The grounds on which the Canadian border patrol turned them back?
Yeah, I mean, because only
what were the grounds?
Most people turned back voluntarily. When they were refused entry and then tried other borders. And anybody who was suspected of participating in protests here who is an American would be refused entry to the United States. And so that's what people were mostly being turned back on, or for prior conviction or prior charges that weren't even convicted. If they were charged at one of the protests in Philadelphia or Seattle or Washington, that was grounds for them to be refused, and people were being refused on that basis.
Leslie Wood, thanks for being with us from the Direct Action Network, speaking to us from Quebec City. Well, a ring of steel, unprecedented levels of security, and tens of thousands of protesters will greet 34 leaders from nations across the Americas today when they open a three-day summit in Quebec City. President Bush will arrive today. Canadian authorities have deployed around 7,000 police and 1,200 troops. They've also built a 10-foot-high fence some 4 miles long to seal off parts of the historic Old City and summit venues. Protesters have dubbed the fence the Wall of Shame and liken it to the Berlin Wall as a symbol of oppression and division. Although the summit will spend no more than half an hour discussing the progress made in FTA negotiations, the protesters have succeeded in ensuring the potential dangers of free trade are at the top of the popular agenda. Protests also are planned far from Quebec City, with marches or blockades planned in other Canadian and U.S. cities and in Tijuana, Mexico, near the border with California, as well as New Mexico. And we're going to be going there shortly. The Electra Hippie Collective said it was targeting websites connected with the summit for protest activity, most likely a flood of email that would hamper operation of the sites. In the next segments, we're going to speak with leading Canadian activists. But before we go there, I had a chance this week to talk with protesters in the United States who are involved in their own actions in different cities and asked if they had a chance to go to Quebec City and ask President Bush a question about the Summit of the Americas, about the free trade area of the Americas. What would that question be?
This is Scott Heinzer from Detroit Stop FTAA Coalition. And I would say to ask President Clinton, or Bush, Clinton Bush, take your choice, President Bush.
Mr. Mark, David Grising joins.
Why is it that the rest of civil society does not get to take part in any of the negotiations, which are being done secretly, except for representation lobbyists from multinational corporations? That would be my first question.
Ann Peterman with the Vermont Mobilization for Global Justice. And I guess I would ask why he should be allowed in the country with a DWI, which Canadians don't allow, you know, Canada doesn't allow people in the country with DWIs, while they simultaneously exclude people with records from nonviolent peaceful protest.
This is Michael McCormack in Kansas City with Solidarity and Unity Now. I guess I would have to ask Mr. Bush or President Bush why it seems that these policies are going to only make a bad situation in the U.S. Even worse, why it is that this is going to increase the inequality, the poverty and oppression, which so many people already see as unacceptable. And that would be my question.
And this is Magali Offerman from the San Diego Stop the FTA Coalition. I don't think I would have so much a question for President Bush, but more of a statement or demand, I guess, that there should be full participation of the communities of the peoples in the Americas in anything that is going to decide their futures, that is going to affect the quality of their lives. So not so much ask him why things are happening, but just say, you know, demand that this needs to be a transparent process and a democratic process.
This is Jason Mark for Global Exchange. My question for Mr. Bush would be that given the failure of energy deregulation here in the state of California, which is going to result in a massive transfer of wealth, billions of dollars from families here in California to energy corporations based largely in Texas, given that experience, why is the U.S. Including in the FTA? Why is the U.S. pushing the FTA for provisions for energy deregulation and other utility and services deregulation around the hemisphere? Hasn't worked in California. Certainly didn't work in Cochabamba, Bolivia, when they tried to privatize their water system there. And so, why are we pushing this failed model across the hemisphere?
This is Jia Qing in San Francisco from Just Act, and I also have a similar question to what Jason was saying, and just more that the privatization agenda in general and the deregulation agenda is being pushed not only in around public resources but also around public services such as education and frighteningly, the running of prison and law enforcement agencies. I would ask President Bush how, when these things are becoming increasingly removed from the public sphere and local geographically local control, how he expects there to be accountability.
Just some of the questions activists have from around this country who are all going to be involved with local protests and teach-ins this weekend of the Summit of the Americas. And you'll be able to see all of their websites and contact information on our website at www.webactive.com. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back with the Canadian leaders, activists in a minute, as well as one of the people who will be at a different border, and that is the U.S.-Mexico border, engaged in teach-ins and protests this weekend as well. Stay with us.
As a united front, united we stand.
You're listening to Democracy Now!, the exception to the rulers. I'm Amy Goodman. As we go now to Quebec City, where protesters are gathering today for major protests against the free trade area of the Americas. We're joined by Jaggi Singh, who is a spokesperson for CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence in Quebec City, Maude Barlow of the Council of Canadians, the largest public advocacy group in Canada, and Philippe Duhamel, who is a spokesperson for Salami. We welcome you all to Democracy Now! Philippe Duhamel, what is Salami?
Well, Salami is basically a citizen-based organization that seeks to organize and participate in education and civil resistance actions and campaigns against the whole corporate rule agenda that we see as part of the Summit of the Americas and the whole free trade negotiations.
It is also a play on words, isn't it?
Right. I mean, we were born out of struggle that succeeded in defeating the multilateral agreement on investments, which is known in French as AMI. We basically said dirty friend to be very educational about what we thought about the MEI.
And what are your plans for today?
Well, basically, there's a lot of people involved. Last night, we had a group of 600 women who redecorated a whole section of the fence with pieces of fabric, images, clothing from various groups in the U.S., actually, and across the Americas. That was very successful. And today, we're devoting a lot of energies in to this citizen FTAA. Not the free trade agreement of the Americas, but a freedom and truth area of the Americas, where about 100 groups are having booths that are open to the public in the harborfront of Quebec City. That will allow also various theater groups and such to do a lot of outreach to the general population and demonstrators in Quebec City. We have also friends and people who are going to take part in various forms of nonviolent direct action around the city, and this promises to be a very interesting day.
Jaggi Singh, you're a spokesperson for CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence. What are your plans for today, and what does the city look like?
Well, the city of Quebec normally has these quaint old city walls, and they've decided to build a whole new set of walls, and the people who built those walls don't quite have the same aesthetic sensibilities. It's an ugly 1-meter-high concrete barricade with a 3-meter-high fence. CLAC, which is the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, along with the Summit of the Americas Welcoming Committee here in Quebec City, we're helping to facilitate some of the direct actions in civil disobedience today. The summit is starting today, and we believe that it's an illegitimate process, that the vision that the summit represents, the summit and the FTAA, is a vision that sees human beings simply as capital, that sees the environment as simply something to be exploited, that sees culture as a commodity. We believe it's illegitimate and should be disrupted, the summit at least, as much as possible. So we're helping to facilitate these direct actions. There was a large spokes council yesterday, and there will be all kinds of decentralized actions, street parties, civil disobedience. It will be an interesting day, that's for sure. One thing I want to make clear, though, is that we haven't been organizing for 1 year for simply 2 days in April. We're now upon those 2 days in April, and they'll be interesting. What CLAC is hoping to do is to mobilize beyond Quebec. What we like to say is it didn't start in Seattle, and it sure as hell isn't going to stop in Quebec, but you can be sure that the next 2 days will be really interesting.
We're also joined on the phone by Maude Barlow of the Council of Canadians. And on your website, canadians.org, you have the booklet that you've put out on the FTAA. For listeners that are just beginning to get a sense of what's going on in Quebec right now and to focus on the Summit of the Americas that U.S. President Bush has just gone up to today, what are the major points you make about explaining what the FTAA is?
Well, first of all, good morning, and hi, Jaggy, and hi, Philippe. We're all different parts of the city, so this is great to talk together. What they're talking about is extending NAFTA to all of the countries of the Americas except Cuba, so 34 other countries of the hemisphere. But it's NAFTA, which is called WTO compatible, so that means more than NAFTA. And it'd be bad enough it's just NAFTA, because that includes water, that includes natural resources, that includes an investment clause that allows corporations to sue governments if they bring in any legislation that these corporations can demonstrate have lost future profits. And so there are literally billions and billions of dollars worth of challenges out now. So this would extend North American corporate hegemony right through the hemisphere and would be just a second colonization for the peoples of the Americas. But what they're also talking about is a full services agreement, which would be health, education, municipal services, prisons, you know, water services, environmental services. Everything that governments now do would be forced open to corporate competition, and corporations would be given equal standing to public institutions in order, in effect, being able to claim public funding. So it really is basically the next level of corporate colonization of all of the peoples of the Americas. And I've done this analysis based, we don't have the text, but we do have a lot of good information, well, bad information, but not happy information, but real, because they set up 9 negotiating committees of the trade bureaucrats of the 34 countries. So we have what they have proposed. And 2 days ago, we got a hold of the investment chapter. So we know what they're proposing. It's the most far-reaching, extreme free trade agreement in the world. And by the way, your listeners can access it on our website, www.canadians.org, in English, French, Spanish, and Portuguese.
Now, just getting a hold of this document has been a major issue. In fact, a number of people were involved in trying to get this document. We went to Canada about a week ago when a government building was taken over to demand the release of the document. Were any of you there?
Philippe and I were both there. It was one of the most moving, the most moving events I've ever been involved in, because it was exceptionally dignified. We have been accused, as you know, of course, of wanting to, you know, destroy this and destroy that. And so we were very clear that we wanted to send a message to the Canadian people about our discipline, and also to say, you know, that we have these fundamental rights. And so there was a great celebration in this event, but also great dignity. And 87 people crossed the barrier, including Philippe, they didn't actually end up charging them, but allowed themselves to become arrested at that moment. And it was really a very powerful signal, and it was only days later that the Government of Canada said that, yes, they would take the message to Buenos Aires, to the all the ministers meeting, all the trade ministers meeting there, to say that the text would be released. But it still hasn't been released. They're now, they said they had to translate it. Well, you can't tell us that the Brazilians are not negotiating with, and don't have the coffee in Portuguese, or the Argentinians aren't using Spanish. We think they're probably rewriting something for public consumption. So it was a win at one level in that they admitted publicly that it's for the first time that citizens should have access to these documents, but it was a loss in that, of course, we're still having to get it by stealth.
We're also joined on the telephone by Jaime Chavez, who is director of the Water Information Network, and he's joining us from Juarez, Mexico, though he lives in New Mexico. Can you explain why you're there today?
Good morning, Amy. How are you doing?
It's good to have you with us.
Good to talk with you again. Yeah, we're getting ready for some very dynamic actions. Last night there was a great poetry reading in downtown El Paso. Jimmy Santiago Baca, a very well-known poet, and myself read to a group of people from El Paso, and we did through our poetry an expose of really the situation that is happening in Mexico, and of course now potentially throughout the hemisphere with the extension of the FTAA. And so we have a few actions planned. Today we have a press conference at the Palacio Municipal here in Juarez, and a number of groups and organizations. This is an organizing effort that the organization I work with, WIN, is connected to, and I'll give you the name of the binational organizing effort, Coordinadora Regional Fronteriza de Organizaciones No Gubernamentales, CODEF, which is a binational organizing effort to connect non-governmental organizations working to improve conditions of the civil society on the border and to gear up for long-term change. And so we're very excited with the people that will be coming today to oppose further militarization of the border and, of course, the impacts of pollution caused by these trade agreements, and to say no to the greedy multinational corporations and no to sweatshop exploitation here on the border and to the maquiladoras, and, of course, no to the assassination of women in Juarez, the disappearance of more than 200 women, working women in Juarez, that have been assassinated and disappeared, and, of course, the lack of government investigation into the matter. No to NAFTA and no to the oppression of Native people. So we're geared up for some very dynamic, festive, symbolic events to bring together people from the states of Chihuahua, Texas, and New Mexico to work on a common agenda with NGOs to solve border problems.
I think it's very interesting, Jaime Chavez. You're with Water Information Network, and Maud Barlow, water has been one of the major issues you've taken on in Canada. Can you, Maud Barlow, talk about your connecting the issue of water with the FTAA, the Free Trade Area of the Americas?
I think it connects at several levels, Amy. The first is that we've been concerned for since the very first free trade agreement in the world, which was the Canada-U.S. Free Trade Agreement, which was signed January 1st, 1989. NAFTA was the next, and now, of course, there have been a proliferation, and on our hemisphere, the FTAA is the third. And water is in NAFTA. It is intended to be in the FTAA as a good, which means that if you start commercially exporting water for commercial purposes, you lose control to the corporations. You cannot maintain control over your own water. And, of course, we are very concerned about that in Canada because we've already
Let me ask that people not move their phones because you're all on together, so the jogging of the phone makes it hard to hear, Maud. Go ahead.
So water is a good. Water, but now we're concerned that they're going to put water as a service into the FTAA, which means that you've got big service corporations, for instance, Azurix, Enron's water division, the big energy company Enron, has now set up a water division, and they are dying to get their hands on all the public services, water services across the continent.
I should add here the perspective in the United States is Enron is one of the major contributors to the George Bush presidential campaign.
Right. And when Mr. Bush talks about a North American Energy Accord, I am absolutely convinced he's including water. But I want to say, Amy, that I think it connects us at another level. I think water is going to be the defining issue for us as a movement across the hemisphere and across the world to take back the commons. We keep saying, all of us, that we're not against certain kinds of trade and certainly not against fair trade, and we feel there are ways you could set up rules that promote fair trade goods and so on. But water, we very much demand that there are certain issues that must be maintained in the commons, health and education, those areas of social security and human rights that are necessary for human survival and human rights, but also the ecological survival of the earth. And I think you're going to see water emerge as these corporations move into Latin America, as they are moving in all over the world and claiming up, they're buying up tracts of land just for the aquifers underneath. They're buying river systems. They're doing deals with governments desperate for their investment. And what we're saying is that this is a connector north to south that we as peoples in the hemisphere and around the world are going to work to take back control of our water.
Jaime Chavez on the Mexico-U.S. border on the issue of water.
Yes. I mean, you know, New Mexico historically is a part of Mexico. And as you know, the mining activities in New Mexico, particularly uranium mining that occurs on Indian lands, poses major threats to aquifers, pristine aquifers that are above EPA levels of, you know, accepted clean water. And, you know, proposed in situ leach mining by corporations out of Dallas, Uranium Resources, Inc., that propose in situ leach mining would dislodge uranium in these aquifers, and the people in those communities are up in arms opposed to this because it will have a tremendous effect on life. And in New Mexico, we have both the front end and the tail end of the impacts of the nuclear fuel chain. In eastern New Mexico and in west Texas, we have a situation developing there that we call the nuclear mall, where you will have a variety of technical services. I mean, from toxic dumping and low-level waste, isolated waste that is being proposed for the entire West Texas and eastern New Mexico areas, which is a path of least resistance because there are poor Mexicano communities, poor ranchers in that area, and they figure and political payback, if you will, in West Texas now that they were not able to get a low-level nuclear dump similar to the Sierra Blanca situation, that you know, they're looking to put a box around Andrews County now and make that one of the largest nuclear dumps, a political payback for major political contributors to the President of the United States, Mr. Bush, through Harold Simmons, who contributed over $400,000 and is one of the chief stockholders and board members of a waste control specialist that just eliminated a competitor in West Texas at Barstow called EnviroCare out of Utah, a horrendous corporate polluter.
You also
we see
have
the all downstream effects of all of this going down to Mexico through these water channels, through the Rio Pecos system and through the Rio Grande, besides all the agrochemical pollution that is connected to that.
You also have Intel, which is the largest semiconductor manufacturing, the largest maker of semiconductors in the world in New Mexico that uses a tremendous amount of water.
Without a doubt. Yeah, they are really working hard on trying to be a good corporate citizen by, of course, making donations to a lot of the nonprofit organizations in the area. But still, I mean, it is lowering the water table and affecting the situation of farmers in the Corrales and in the valley areas. And, you know, it's basically, as you know, a situation where corporate welfare, because of the lack of economic development in those areas, city and county and, municipal governments are really opening the door to this type of industry because of a lack of grassroots, I would say, solutions to economic development.
There are a number of actions that will be taking place on the Mexico border. When we come back from our break, we're going to go back up to Canada. But the actions there from New Mexico to San Diego, Jaime Chavez, what will you be involved with this weekend?
We have a very tomorrow there will be a protest in Parque San Jacinto in El Paso. Which is some of the information says, this is the capitalist rough draft for the corporate constitution of the world, and in fact, this is not a constitution of the people, by the people, and for the people. And so there's going to be a very lively action at Plaza San Jacinto at from 11 o'clock to 1 o'clock p.m., and on Sunday, a major action recognizing Día de la Tierra, or Earth Day, and we intend to bring together the binational coalition of NGO organizations at the Juarez Bridge and also at the Zaragoza Bridge on the Mexican side. And, of course, these actions will seek to promote nonviolent solutions to social problems throughout the entire border region.
Well, Jaime Chavez, if people want to get in touch through the web or by phone, how can they?
Well, I'll go ahead and give the hotline number on the ground over here. They can contact ourselves, that people that are working both in
Real
Paso
quick.
And in Juarez, 915-873-6475, and in Juarez, 615-6546, and of course using the international access code.
And we'll put those numbers at the website, www.webactive.com. I want to thank you for being with us from the Water Information Network, speaking to us from Juarez, Mexico. You are listening to Democracy Now! As we'll go back up to Canada and then end with Mike Davis, a professor who's moved from Los Angeles to New York, who has his perspective on the FTAA. Jaggi Singh is with us, spokesperson for the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, CLAC, Maude Barlow, Council Canadians, and Philippe Dahamel speaking to us with the group Salami. You're listening to Democracy Now! Back in a minute.
Yeah.
You're listening to Democracy Now! Free Speech Radio as we continue in Canada on this day of protest and resistance in Quebec City and around the Americas. We are joined by Maude Barlow, Council Canadians, Jaggi Singh of CLAC, the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, and Philippe Dahamel, spokesperson for Salami. And they are all in Quebec City for today's protests. The issue of direct action and also property damage, which has become one of the themes we've been talking about this week. Jaggi Singh, your perspective on it.
Well, you know, Amy, there's going to be some violent people coming to Quebec City today. They're organized and they're motivated, and those violent people are the 34 heads of state of this hemisphere. They are responsible for structural violence, the violence of poverty, the displacement of indigenous people. When you make cuts to social programs, such as the government here in Canada did, to billions of dollars, that has profound consequences in society. And that level of profound day-to-day violence far and above outweighs any potential for violence by protesters. We want to try to disturb the summit as much as possible. We're not talking about a shutdown because it's sort of hard to talk about a shutdown when the city is sort of already shut down for you by a huge police operation. But in any case, we want to make our case heard loud and clear. And put the emphasis on where that real violence resides. And by the same token, try to create a spirit of solidarity amongst demonstrators. That's our goal today, the specific goal today. And that's, I think, where we're going to try to target our message, the fact that those 34 leaders, those police, the policies that they're responsible for have very, very violent consequences in society. And that's what we're opposing.
Mm-hmm. Philippe Dahamel, I know this has divided your groups to a certain extent. Your take on this?
Well, I would totally concur with Jaggi about the massive violence of this system that we're facing now, with over 100 species disappearing every day, 65 kids dying every minute of hunger. We are faced with one of the most violent systems that has existed on this planet, and our very survival is threatened. But there are issues within the movement that need to be addressed, and certainly we do need a long-term strategy to actually turn this movement, which is still emerging, which is still nascent, into a really powerful mass movement. Now, one of the issues has been this diversity of tactics. We'll see how it plays out in the streets today. Something to keep in mind is that the movements are still experimenting with various takes on tactics and strategies. We'll see. But certainly, we got to be very mindful of, as Jaggi said, and there's also, 6,500 men, mostly, who are dressed in black, who have been practicing throwing all kinds of projectiles for months, and we're talking about the police. We do believe that in order for this to become a mass movement, we got to have a very clear symbolic contrast between protesters and the repression forces. We also must be very mindful of the fact that agents provocateurs have systematically been used, at least in this part of the world. And we got to really think about how to win the hearts and minds of people and make actions that allow children to take part, the handicapped. We got to be very responsible. Some people could get hurt very badly just for the action of some individuals. And I understand that there's attempts to sort of define zones and stuff like that, but maybe there's still too much vagueness about what's going to go on, what tactics are going to be happening, because certainly not all tactics are going to work in every context. So we'll see how it plays out, but we'll need to debrief after that and learn the lessons of Quebec City, much as we had to learn about the lessons of Seattle and Washington and all the other protests. This is an experiment, and we hope the movement really grows from here on.
The way the mainstream press has been playing the Summit of the Americas is Latin leaders, are they going to, do they believe that George Bush could push through an agreement in the Congress? That's been the major issue, Maude Barlow of Council of Canadians. Will he be able to get a treaty like this or an agreement like this passed?
Well, there's great dissension, as you know, both within the United States around this, but also through the Americas. And I just want to say, Amy, that the way we won the multilateral agreement on investment and the way we shut down Seattle was both our civil society movement on the ground and on the streets, but also the incredible work that was done within countries with all variety of groups, from peasants to farmers to food activists to human rights activists and so on, saying to their governments, don't you dare go and give away these rights. We're watching you. The most important component of this whole thing is a politically charged civil society. What happened with the MAI is that when we got a hold of it, they told us it didn't exist. When we got it in a brown paper bag, at that point it was almost finished in terms of the negotiations. Within a year, we had doubled the number of reservations. We'd forced our governments to double the number of exemptions and reservations they were claiming, and it just fell into a great big puddle of dissent, and they ended up fighting with each other and pulled out. Similarly, in Seattle, what happened was it wasn't just on what we did on the streets, although that was incredibly important, and it wasn't just the third world delegates, although they were terribly important, but it was also the infighting between the so-called first world governments, because they had their constituencies at home. I mean, I love that the Europeans were fighting with each other. The trade ministers were prepared to sign a genetically engineered a treaty on genetic engineering food, basically banning countries' rights to control it. Well, their health and environment ministers were saying, "Are you crazy? We can't go back and face our constituents."
Maude Barlow.
That's what we're going to do here in the Americas. We're going to destabilize this within our own countries and attack it the same way. And there's a tremendous movement in the United States with whom we work and upon whom
we
do. Well,
I want to thank you all for being with us. Maude Barlow of the Council of Canadians, Jaggi Singh of the Anti-Capitalist Convergence, and Philippe Dahmel, spokesperson for Salamé, all in Quebec City for the protest today. And we're going to end with a speech given at a recent teach-in on the free trade area of the Americas in New York by Mike Davis, who's now a professor in the history department at the State University of New York, Stony Brook.
I spent the spring break in Montreal, eating, drinking, demonstrating, eating, drinking. When I arrived, La Presse, which is the major French language paper in Montreal, predicted that 5,000 people would demonstrate at Quebec City. When I left 8 days earlier, La Presse was talking about over 25,000 people. And this is a dramatic index of the growing rage and anger in Quebec. First of all, against the secrecy of the whole process. Secondly, against what many people feel in Quebec will be the outcome of FTAA for Quebec's system of public education and public health if it's put in competition with things like the University of Phoenix and American HMOs. But above all, popular revulsion against the militarization of Quebec City, where a fence some 4 meters high has been going to be erected around the whole center of the city, and the majority of citizens of Quebec City will be excluded from it. Only people who live in the area with proper passes will be admitted. More than 5,000 police will be mobilized, backed up by the Canadian forces. Nothing like this has been seen in Quebec since the so-called emergency of 1970 and the struggle by the Front for the Liberation of Quebec. The police have been going around to all the bus companies in Quebec and also in Ontario, trying to discourage them from providing transportation, leasing any buses to demonstrators, saying they're all going to be anarchists and rioters. And of course, as you well know, the Premier Chrétien's government has taken the position that entry into Canada is a privilege, not a right, particularly to be denied to, you know, to protesters. So what we have here is what a Quebecois friend of mine characterized as, he said, c'est très NAFTA. It's the most dramatic refutation possible of the claim that the United States has made, first by the Clinton administration and now by the Bush administration, that hemispheric free trade and unregulated capitalism is the keystone of preserving parliamentary democracy in the Western Hemisphere. But what we see clearly around Quebec City is that free trade is not about eliminating borders and tearing down, you know, barriers. It's quite the inverse. This is about imposing new borders. It's about a proliferation of borders. It's about putting up barriers against ideas, against expression of dissent, and against movement of people. This is an old conceit. In the 19th century, the British ideologues of free trade argued that a world of free trade would be a world at peace, you know, a world of internationalism and solidarity amongst nations. Free trade, in fact, meant a world constructed by, you know, gunboats and opium, famines that killed tens of millions of people, colonial genocides, you know, the whole heart of darkness that, you know, we know so well. In the case of the Western Hemisphere in the 20th century, which has witnessed one of the most sustained long-term experiments with unregulated capitalism and free trade, the result is that at the end of the 20th century, incomes in Latin America as a proportion of U.S. incomes are considerably less than they were at the beginning of the 20th century, and that inequalities of wealth in many of the countries of Latin America, above all in Colombia and Brazil, were greater than they were at the beginning of the 20th century. There's a huge new middle class in Brazil and elements of it in Mexico and other countries. It's more than balanced by the cities of misery, by the tens of millions of, you know, people who live in absolute poverty, by the mothers in northeast Brazil who can't afford to cry when their children die because infant mortality is a daily fact. This has been the reality of the Western Hemisphere's experience with unregulated capitalism in the 20th century. And indeed, it would probably be easier to argue that there's a direct contradiction between capitalism and democracy in Latin American history than any kind of equation. Now, I've been asked to make some suggestions about an alternative hemispheric order to that proposed by the Quebec Summiteers. And I must confess to you, in all honesty, that I believe, as I did when I attended a meeting in this church in late 1964 to help organize the first March on Washington against the Vietnam War, that socialism is the true and only hope of the world. And I believe that today, but I'm not going to offer you any blueprint for that. Only make two suggestions of a practical kind to people headed toward Quebec City. First, use this opportunity to talk to and meet and establish some relationship with your sisters and brothers in Quebec. I think probably most of us don't realize that Montreal in the 1960s and 70s had the largest urban left, the most progressive grassroots politics of any big North American city. Quebec labor movement and social movements, women movements, have moved mountains in the last 20, 30 years. And it was very exciting to be in Montreal last week with demonstrations breaking out at undeclared times and places, you know, all over the east side, the working class, French-speaking east side of Montreal. So this is a wonderful opportunity to begin to familiarize yourself with this great other nation, French-speaking nation in North America that few of us know about. Even more practically, I would suggest to those of you who are in the direct action networks that you might want to consult Francis Parkham's great work, his multi-volume history of the struggle between the English and French empires over North America, particularly Volume 3, Montcalm and Wolfe. Now, the Chrétien government has been arguing that its security measures in Quebec City are absolutely invulnerable. This was the same position taken by Viscount and General Montcalm in 1759. One of the reasons, of course, Quebec City was picked for this meeting is that it's the only walled city in, you know, North America. And in 1759, Montcalm said, you know, the city's invulnerable. The British have no chance of taking it. But Francis Parkman gives you detailed instructions on how you can follow the same path that the Gordon Highlanders of General Wolfe used to successfully break into Quebec City in 1759. All power to the Mohawk people. Thank you.
And that was Mike Davis, professor in the history department at SUNY Stony Brook and longtime activist, also author of many books, including City of Courts. And that does it for today's program. If you'd like to order a cassette copy, call 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can write to us by email at mail@democracynow.org. That's mail@democracynow.org. Democracy Now! Is produced by Terry Allen and Chris Abrams. Anthony Sloan is our engineer. Errol Maitland, our technical director. Special thanks to Brother Shine. From the embattled studios of WBAI, from the studios of The Band and The Fired, from the studios of our listeners, I'm Amy Goodman. Thanks for listening to another edition of Democracy Now!
This message has been brought to you by WMFW, which means we must fight and win.